No, no, because you vent out all your anger or joy, and then what we get on the actual podcast is this sort of shadow.
No, it's not.
Passion.
I have never been accused of shadows of passion. Oh, that's a really good book title. Shadows of Passion.
Writer and Critic, episode...
No. 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 Just no.
Okay. I'm just trying different things. That's all. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a bi-monthly podcast, thank you, devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy.
Indeed.
This is episode 41, and as you pointed out, it's a palindrome of an episode because we are recording on the 14th
yes.
of December, which also happens to be my brother's birthday. So oh. happy birthday to Robert.
Happy birthday, Robert. Mond. Will he listen to this?
Not
okay.
in hell.
Okay, that's a waste of 10 seconds.
Correct.
So, I wanted to talk about something.
Welcome, Kirsten, by the way, and welcome to me, Ian Mond.
Welcome, Ian.
Yeah, welcome, Kirsten. I know we don't do this often enough, so you forget the etiquette of podcasts, but I know I have to remind you, and here I am reminding you.
Oh, shut up.
Yeah, well, there we're back.
How's
into
that for etiquette?
No, we're good.
Okay. So, something was brought inadvertently to my attention recently. And I had someone email me about a different matter, but they asked if we reviewed Australian books on a podcast or only international ones. And I thought, oh, that's weird. We review heaps of Australian books. And then I went and had a look.
How many have we done?
Do you know, apart from the Aurealis episode that we did earlier this year with those two books that we did not choose, we just did them because they both won an Aurealis award. The last time we reviewed an Australian book was in September 2012.
Oh, God.
And that was Kate Forsyth's Bitter Greens. And I thought, wow, that's really weird. Like, I realised, actually, it's our own fault for being cowardly. we kind of have this, it's not a rule, but it's this kind of discomfort, I guess, with reviewing books of people who we're friends with or who we know.
And you're saying because the market
and we know
so, small,
so many people in Australia spec fic that it's
that's not
it's
my excuse. That's not my excuse.
That's not your excuse.
I have a genuine cultural cringe to a good chunk of Australian work. Yep.
Well, I think we need to rectify it.
Yep.
So I'm going to put on my big girl pants, as Elisa Krasnstein would say, and I'll recommend a book at the end of the podcast by someone who is Australian and who I know quite well. So that, and I haven't read yet, so that's going to be really all sorts of scary.
So what, we're not going to say anything now?
No, I recommend it at the end.
Okay, so you're going
to
do that.
I think we need
I'm
to
not
start.
Going to be doing that because I already have my...
Yeah, I know, no, but I think we need to start, well, maybe I need to start then. You need to get over your cultural cringe, but I need to start sucking it up, and if I read a book that I like and it's by someone I know, I can just review it anyway and not worry that...
Here's the thing. I want to justify myself. Can I?
Please do.
Okay. So I am, and I've started probably the last 6 months, reading awards lists.
I've noticed that on your blog.
Yeah. But there's no Australian awards list that I'm reading. I'll rectify that next year, but not... But even so, even if I do rectify that, we're still only talking a handful of books in amongst potentially over. I've actually counted. If I want to do about 23 award lists next year. The chances of me doing 23 award lists next year are a gazillion to one. But there are 23 awards lists that I'm interested in.
That is an awards list a fortnight. You have to read a whole short list a fortnight.
It's just the novels. And there's overlap.
Yeah, okay, there's overlap. Well, that will.
And I'll probably get rid
you.
Of the Stokers because I've put that in there. But I'll probably get rid of that.
Wow.
Okay. So it's really probably 22. So we're in that I've counted at least one category, and I choose the category.
Well,
I'm not going to do the whole.
Well, maybe you could do the winners instead of the shortlists of all the things.
That's
you could
a possibility,
just read,
yes.
Because there are.
Yeah, that's not a. Well, yeah. Well, I'd only be doing the novels. I wouldn't be doing
well,
short fiction.
That
no, that's
anyway.
Actually not such a bad idea. Although the collections section of the Aurealis is always very good. I was thinking of actually focusing on that because. I'm not looking at collections generally, but maybe I will do the winners as well. I don't know. We'll see. It depends on my time because, yes, you're right, 23, well, now 22.
Wow, it's quite shortlists, a bit.
And most of which are, it's a half and half between genre and literary as well. Anyway, the point I'm making is there's not a lot of Australian stuff in there, so I'm not reading much Australian stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you count Richard Flanagan.
Unless you count Richard Flanagan.
And that's not genre.
No, true.
So I actually blame genre awards for not nominating enough Australian writers, because then I'd be forced and compelled to read them. Although I did read Rupetta this year.
Okay. Well, that's your reasoning.
Yeah.
And mine really is that I have read a lot of books by Australians over the past couple of years, but haven't recommended them for the podcast.
Because these people are your friends. You don't want to tell them how shit their work is.
I'm either their friends. It's not that. I might really like the book, but I feel
often you don't,
though. Awkward that, if I recommend a book that I really like, but it's by a friend, then how am I disentangling
the
friendship from that?
Come
on. Yeah, no, I'm just saying that's my concern, but I will get over it because I feel it has become detrimental to us not actually talking about Australian books on a podcast in Australia about books. And the fact that it has been noticed by at least one person who didn't think we did Australian books.
Yeah, that's troubling. That actually is pretty bad. The NowTour.com podcast, the Cood Street podcast,
mm-hmm.
now of the tour.com family of podcasts. Mm-hmm. They did an excellent episode some weeks ago.
On Australian science fiction. Yes.
Which you can link to. You should link to it.
I will link to that.
Thank you.
I'll put that in the show notes.
Anywho, listening to that, I was quite embarrassed.
Didn't read much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I should have read all the 12 Planet books.
You haven't?
I've read yours. I've read a bunch of them. I've read zero. And I will, you know.
I'm kidding.
You're not kidding.
A little bit.
People can't see your face.
Okay.
Like, I haven't read the Rosaline Love one, which is only very short. No, but the point is, I was quite embarrassed by what. I don't know. It's odd. You know, we're brought up on a diet of, this is us young Australians,
mm-hmm.
who are readers, are brought up on a diet of science fiction from the UK and the US, and mostly mm-hmm. the US. That's what we're brought up on.
Yeah.
And so we immediately gravitate to that. And, yes, there are people like me who are very prejudiced and discriminatory by nature. I mean, you just should see me in the workforce. And and feel the need, you know, feel that sort of there is a cultural cringe and feel the need. Like Margot Lanigan. Well, she's now been.
Do you think it's sad, though, that there still is this cultural cringe?
Can I finish my point?
Yes, please go.
And because I'll get to that. Margot Lanigan's now been accepted worldwide internationally. Mm. Therefore, she's okay.
Therefore, she's okay.
I can read her.
So you have to be accepted internationally.
You are brought up with that culture. I was brought up with a cultural cringe.
It's true.
Absolutely.
Oh, look, as I was telling you in the car on the way here, a little anecdote. For those of you who haven't heard me talk about it elsewhere, one of my favourite movies now is The Babadook, which is an Australian
Do you want to make a link to the podcast?
Horror film. I will make a link.
To The Martian. Is it The Martian Drive-In?
Oh, yes. I was on the Terry Frost's podcast talking about The Babadook, the Martian drive-in.
Quite passionately, I should say.
Yeah, I really, 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 really love this movie. I think it's phenomenal and I highly recommend it. But I saw it kind of accidentally because my husband and I just went to the movies because we had a free ticket and picked it off a poster because the poster looked interesting. And that was really it. Knew nothing about it at all. Sitting in the movies. Screen, you know, everything goes dark, credits start coming up on the screen. And it's funny because Jason and I talked about it afterwards. We both had exactly the same response when, you know, funding credits for Screen Australia and South Australian Film came up. And we both kind of had this sinking feeling. It's like, oh, no, it's an Australian horror film. Which is really terrible. Like, it's a horrible instant reaction to have, especially as there are good Australian horror films out there.
Name another one.
Wolf Creek.
Okay, you did. Good.
But
there's a few years between those two.
But it is this instant reaction, and it's really. And I felt really, really bad. And, you know, the thing is, if The Babadook hadn't been a great movie, I probably wouldn't have felt bad. It would just have just validated.
We are brought up by we've got a tall poppy syndrome issue in Australia,
yeah,
which
we do.
I don't know if anyone else uses that term and or knows what that means, but this idea of if someone gets too big for their boots,
yeah.
We like to cut them down to size.
Yeah, we like people only as long as they're not that great.
Correct. And yet, if Russell Crowe is nominated for an Oscar, we will forget the fact that we will forget the fact that he's a New Zealander and we'll own him as an Australian. So if and only when that person has been,
so they're going to get super big.
Yeah, they've got to have been accepted by the international community before we will accept them.
So they've either got to be really small and indie and grungy, and we can proclaim knowledge of them, and it's kudos to us because we found this small independent person that no one knows about, or they're super huge and everyone agrees they're good, so we can put up our hand and say, well, they're ours, but all this middle ground is like, ew.
Correct.
That's really fucked up.
Correct. Correct. And I'd like to tell you that, as of this year, I'm not like that anymore, but I am.
Well, you obviously,
and it's time to change that, I suppose.
Yeah. So thank you to the person who brought that to my attention. You know who you are. So, yes, I will tell you what book I'm recommending for next year at the end of this podcast.
So if you want to know, skip straight to that or just read the show notes, because I have no idea what it is.
No, you have no idea.
The listener will know if they just read the show notes.
Shut up, Ian.
Okay.
Some people don't. They just get this on iTunes and they never, ever read the show notes.
You spend like 9 weeks restructuring those notes.
I know. The proofreaders, the editors.
Do you remember
like
we used to
process.
Swap that? I did it, that you did it.
No, you did it once,
okay,
Ian.
Twice,
you did it once.
Twice.
You did it the first time and then I did it every other time.
Yeah, in my style.
Well, no, I don't do it in your style anymore because it's tedious.
Okay. Once again, I've been schooled.
Don't get that. You remember how we used to swap them? No. Remember how I took over after the first episode? I think that's the memory you're reaching for. Anyway, so more Australian content next year. Yay.
Better be fucking good. No, great.
Oh.
Better be as good as all that international stuff I read. Richard Flanagan. Anyway, yes. See, we now own Richard Flanagan because he's won a Man Booker. I mean, really, who was talking about Richard Flanagan before that? They were talking about his brother, who's a sports writer.
Is he?
Yeah. Writes about cricket.
Ah.
Martin Flanagan, I think it is. Anyway, they're talking about him, but Richard, yeah, he'd written a couple of books, yeah, auteur, whatever. Were people talking about him? No, but now.
Well, that is what these Blue Chip Award processes do. They do highlight people to a wider audience who otherwise wouldn't know about them. I don't think we can say necessarily that that's a bad thing.
No. Look, you'd finish the point and I re-raised it again.
Yes.
And so I apologise.
So we will move on to the books for this month.
Neither
written by an Australian. And I also did break another one of my little rules that I had not read the book I recommended. And this may happen quite a few times next year because I am squeezed for time in my reading. So I often will be just pulling a book off the to-be-read shelf that I want to read and hopefully I'll like it. So
Healed.
The first book we're going to talk about that I have had on my to-be-read shelf for over a year, so long that, in fact, the paperback has just come out and I have the hardcover.
Which is gorgeous.
Which is
because I've also got that. I've got exactly that hardcover.
It
I read it a bit sooner than you did.
Beautiful book. So it's Healed by Nicola Griffith. This is the first book, which I'm not sure I knew when I first bought it. I knew before I read it, but yeah, I can't remember whether I knew when I first acquired it that it was the first of what is going to be a trilogy about the life of
She
of
had
Healed.
Mentioned it on her blog. And frankly, if you're halfway through.
Oh, yeah, no. Well,
you
knew,
sort of go,
I knew before I started reading it.
You sort of go, shit, she's got to grow up real quick in the second half.
Well, two-thirds of the way through and she's still 10.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I did know before I started reading it, though. Like it's, at some point I had acquired the knowledge this was book one. Not that the book itself says anywhere on it.
And
like
it
if you book this book off a shelf,
yeah,
you wouldn't know it was the first book.
Does it really need to, though? Does it need to? So, I mean, I know
I
people
think
are very.
It's important for some people.
It is important. No, this is what the point I'm making. It is very important for some people.
But it also might turn people off. Like if people look at a book one of on the shelf, they might go, oh, it's a
But
book
as
one.
A novel, it is very self-contained.
Oh, I think it is. It's beautiful.
And
it's
if you put book
novel.
One on there, you assume that, well, obviously there's going to be other books, but that it's probably not that self-contained. But you can just, I'm of the view that if I never read the second and third book, I don't think, I'll lose out on the historical stuff, but I won't feel like I've missed anything.
It is a book that tells a story, that tells
that
a complete
terrible.
Story.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Correct.
And I mean, the thing is, you know,
well, okay,
historically,
can I just
you know,
I want to know more about Hild,
yes.
But I don't necessarily need another book written about Hild. That sounds worse than the thing I said before. Maybe I should have just stopped that. I want to read
Let
more
me
about
take that shovel
Hild.
Out of your hand.
I want to read more. There's no way out, is there?
There's really no way out. Do you need a ladder for that hole?
Well, I've got to now spend the next 45 minutes apologising because I really love this book.
No, okay, I do know what you mean. It was a satisfying read in and of itself.
Oh, my God. How do you do that? Why am I not able to do that?
However, you are very glad that Nicola Griffith is writing two more books.
I know. Yes, I am. Really, absolutely.
Okay.
No, I actually want to know. I want to know how she becomes a.
Okay. So for those who don't know, Hild is the first novel in what is going to be a trilogy of books exploring an imaginative history of the woman who would become St. Hilda of Whitby, an abbess in 7th century Britain.
Yes.
And yeah, it's such an astonishingly good book. St. Hilda hasn't got, as Nicola Griffith has pointed out in an afterword to this book actually, but also on her website, there's not a lot of actual history.
Well, it's fuck all.
Written about St.
No,
Hilda.
No, there's actually fuck all.
Yes, yeah, well, I'm getting to that. So there's about 5 pages.
The Venerable Bede.
In Venerable Bede's history. And that's it. That's all we know about St. Hilda. So there's this massive canvas to paint in. And that's exactly what this book does. But so it's important that this is written as a novel, and that Nicola Griffith isn't making a claim to historical fact here, and he acknowledges in the matter around the book that this is an imagined world.
Yeah.
In fact, I've seen her talk in an interview, and I think she actually wrote about this on her blog too at one stage, where she said what she basically did, and it's a lovely writerly metaphor, is that she built the 7th century from scratch. Like, she went and did the research for 10 years and she researched everything about the 7th century, and then she kind of built this world and put Hild in it.
It's contradictory. You're contradicting. It doesn't make sense. Yes, I've heard what Nicola said about the world-building site, but she isn't doing true world-building in the sense that it's a completely made-up world that she's, as you said, invented from scratch. She's taken years of experience.
She built it from scratch. She took all of her research.
She didn't build it from scratch because it's a real 7th century was a real time, a real place.
If you say you went and built a house, I'm not assuming you actually went and fired your bricks and cut your trees and invented some new polymer to put. You took all the materials and you built a house, and that's what Nicola Griffith has done. She's done all of the research. She researched this book for about 10 years. And when I say this book, she researched the 6th and 7th century Britain for about 10 years and everything from the agriculture to the economy to the, like, every aspect of it that she could get her hands on, the language, the faiths and the religion, all of this stuff. And using all of that material, she built the world of her book based on, the reality of 7th century Britain.
Yeah, okay. This is where I get all that. This is not a negative or a plus. Mm. This is just, there's this whole discussion because it was nominated for the Nebula.
Yeah.
And she was on, again, the Coot Street podcast. We've mentioned again, God, like they need the promotion. actually fantastic interview, where she did say that because of this world-building side, there's not a fantastical element, but it's inspired very much by fantasy world building.
Yeah. She's used the tools she learnt writing fictional worlds.
And she would have had to have made, because as good as the research may or may not be of 7th century Britain, she will have had to have made things
up. Oh, absolutely. And drawn connections.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Except that. Except, you know, she hasn't thrown in anachronisms from what I can tell, other than the language of the book itself. And I'm going to get.
She's been very careful about. From all accounts, anyway.
Well, I'm going to get to that later.
Yeah.
But it's not like, there's genuine fantastical elements in this. There's no...
No, it's an imaginative history. But it's set in our world. Like, she's had to imagine the biographical details of Hild to a huge extent.
Yes.
Considering the skeletal biography that we have of this woman. And she acknowledges that. She's not trying to write a biography. She's not trying to do historical research and write something that she's presenting as, here is this woman and this is exactly how her life was. It seems to be an impossible task in any case, and she's certainly making no claim to that. She's writing a fiction. She's writing a novel.
But the coming of Christianity, for example,
yeah.
that's but historical fact.
Yeah, but she's basing it on real history and the real world and the past that has happened, and she has built that from her research, Because, you know, I mean, when you talk about world building, it doesn't necessarily mean fantasy world building. It means constructing the world in your book so that when people read it, they feel like they're walking around in this world, whether that is, you know, an alternate world or a science fiction world or an impossible world, or whether it is a historical world or a current world. Right, a contemporary novel said you have to feel like you're walking in this world and it makes sense. And when people talk about world building, I think that phrase can often be taken over and hijacked in a way by the idea that world building just means constructing a fantasy world that doesn't and possibly couldn't exist. World building in terms of writing.
Also that you've made it up off your own.
And that you've made it up. You've made it up.
There are no other antecedents or anything else like that.
Which is complete rubbish anyway, because there are always antecedents. But that's the thing. World building in a book is about building the environment of the book. And there are different ways to do it. And if you're doing contemporary world, your world building can often, you know, you can make use of shortcuts because people assume, oh, this is the world. Okay, so you don't have to do. But Nicola Griffith hasn't been able to do that because, you know, the lay reader doesn't know what the medieval world was like. We can't make assumptions about what people did and what their day-to-day life was around, because this is like a millennium, more than a millennium.
No, but she's taking a risk here, because there will be people who have researched this, possibly even more than her.
Yeah.
And it's a...
But that's a risk anyone takes.
Okay, all right. No.
I mean, come on. Because the thing is, she's not... That's a risk any novelist... That's a risk any historian takes.
Yeah, no, true.
You know, history is, you know, largely... It's a story. It's a story that tries to get as close to reality as possible, but it is interpretive work.
Look, I don't want to get bogged down in this, because I can easily get bogged down in this. I suppose when I pick up a book like Hild, I have to put trust in the author that they've done the research, which she clearly has, and that they're not just pulling shit, anachronistic crap out of their ass, which she clearly isn't. Well, it's clearly to me. I mean, how would I know?
Yeah.
I mean, really, seriously, how would I know? But you've got to have some trust in the author. And just the way it's written and the way it's so engaging, I did immediately have trust. I never thought that, you know, it read in such a way that I wouldn't have thought that she actually had to do much inventing, that she's just plucked a book from the shelf and just made this world via, you know, she's got millions of sources that she can rely on.
Yeah.
And that's what she's done here. But it's an amazing effort that she's put in
to create what is
very real, which, you know, feels like 7th century Britain. Not that I would actually know how 7th century Britain
feels. It feels like...
It feels like the past.
But it feels like an incredibly rich and textured and detailed world.
Yes.
And you know, her writing style, her word choices and the language that she uses, it helps that immersive feeling. I mean, you smell things when you're reading this book. You know, there's textures, there's stuff you feel.
Yes.
Her language is really exquisite in terms of evoking sensation in the reader. And she has created this amazing world that you really do fall into when you're reading the book. It's the kind of the world that you're constantly aware of. You know, there's always something which is a new thing. You know, some little detail of life that you're like, of course they would have had to do that kind of thing. You know, it's always there.
Like how they move from court to court depending on the seasons and things like that.
Yeah, it informs like the. Everything that's in the book is interlinked. So it's not like, here's this backdrop of, you know, 7th century Britain and we're going to actually focus on the politics or the wars. Everything is interlinked. The economy, the environment, the seas, like everything affects everything else.
Yep.
And this is illustrated beautifully.
Oh, I mean, just having a decent war chest, you know, even if you're not in battle,
the
ability to pay your knights and your soldiers.
Yeah.
Is critical, because if you don't pay them, they just go
and
you're dead.
And the reliance of every person in this world upon so many other people to do anything is quite phenomenal. I think this is a really, considering also that we should say that the people that this book focuses on are the elite. You know, these are the royalty and the, you know, the what would become, I guess, the lords and the so on.
Yeah.
You know, these aren't just the everyday people working the land and doing stuff. So to an extent, these are the people who are better off, who have more power, who have more time.
Go and say it,
to
privileged.
Do stuff. And more privileged, but privilege lends them this these things.
Still a bloody tough life.
And yet still, it is a, you know, it is still like you work every day, all day.
Everyone's working.
Yeah, everyone is working. Everyone is doing things. Your day is full. There is no such thing as spare time, really.
Yeah.
He'll manage to carve out little bits, but even that is sort of a problem for her because then people are a bit suspicious.
Well, Hild, and this is getting to the novel, Hild becomes critical to the decisions that the king makes because she makes based on – she's very intuitive.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were
and
reading –
deductive.
This, and deductive, correct. If you were reading this as a fantasy novel, you could say that she was getting magical insights into the – or prophetic insights,
and
I
that's
should
how
say.
She's positioned. She's has been positioned by her very clever mother.
Yes.
And then by herself, she has taken on the mantle of the king's seer.
Yes.
And so the connotations around this for most of the world are connotations of prophecy and witchcraft and something that's above the natural.
But she's just, you know, the first
but
iteration.
But Hild herself doesn't.
She's the first iteration of Sherlock Holmes or something like that. No, I know.
I am so sick of that.
I know. It's glib.
She
I know.
Uses her Sherlockian powers of deduction.
I know, because that's what I put in my review on my blog, which I know is which is a bit silly.
You weren't the only one.
But it feels like. I mean, I know it's not. I know. But it does feel that way.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, she's not just using powers of deduction, though. She is using what I guess a lot of. Some practitioners these days would call cold reading. So she's very good at reading people. And she sees the, like her big thing is all throughout the book it's used to describe what she does and how she sees the world as a pattern. And she sees the pattern. And the pattern is made up of the natural world. It's made up of seasons. It's made up of people. It's made up of the things people do. And she's able to find the pattern in things. And once you see a pattern, you can see where the pattern will lead. And that's what she's able to do. And because weaving and fabric work is such a huge part and was a huge part of the lives of women, it's a huge part of Hild's life and her mother's life and all the women around her. And this is the, I guess, the structural metaphor that the book uses to describe Hild and how she sees the world and what she does with her life.
Yeah,
and she uses it herself. She talks about the warp and the weft and how her mother is forming a pattern that she can't quite see yet. And that's tied up with her notion of the weird, which is another pattern. It's her place and her path in the world. And yeah, it's just beautifully done because everything comes back to that.
But don't just think that she's someone who sits back and sees for the king, because for one, her life is on the line. Get it wrong and
if you set yourself up as a prophetic seer and your prophecy doesn't come to pass, you're kind of screwed.
Yes.
And there are a couple of very real moments in that book where she's basically just gambling.
Yes.
Like when she's predicting that the king's second wife is going to have a son.
Correct.
And that he'll be healthy, the second of which cannot be taken for granted.
Correct.
So that's just a gamble. She has no idea. That is just a gamble.
Yeah, and her life is on the line for that. And the other thing is what I found really interesting, probably because of my male prejudice, how violent she is, how she goes into battle, how she...
Yeah, because she's not... Yes, she doesn't remain at court. She's actually a very active figure.
I thought that, even though they're actually the front cover, because she's in armour, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's not quite... But anyway.
Okay. I found that to be quite... I found it fascinating that she's not just sitting at the side of the king providing prophecies. She's out there getting her hands very much bloody.
And sometimes she has to be because she sees something that needs to be done and she can't... She can't convince the king for various reasons. Sometimes she doesn't have enough information to convince the king. Sometimes it's just something he wouldn't want to do. So often she does have to take matters into her own
hands. And how old is she in doing all this?
I know. I kept forgetting she was
a
teenager.
Correct. She's barely a teenager.
Yeah.
Barely a teenager.
By the end of the book, I think she might be 14,
something
15,
like that, yeah.
Because she was baptised, according to the Venerable Bede, she was baptised at 13, and I think the book continues for about a year or so after that.
So
sometimes it's hard to track her exact
age. Now, of course, in that time, you grew up a bit quicker than you do today.
Yes, definitely.
But still, she's not. She's very young.
She's a very smart kid. She's a very smart child. When she's like...
She's precocious,
when
Kirsten.
She's 6 or 7, she's such a smart child.
She's precocious.
But she's quiet. She watches. When she's very young, she doesn't do a lot. She watches.
Yes.
And notes. And there's a passage I'm going to read, actually, which...
I did wonder why you would open the book.
Yeah, no, because there's a passage I would like to read that's talking about how Hild sees her what she does as a seer, and it's really beautifully put. Auguries and sacrifice, crude tools of toothless petitioners, or so her mother said, even as she'd rehearsed Hild in every variation. But she said over and over, there was no power like a sharp and subtle mind weaving others' hopes and fears and hungers into a dream they wanted to hear. Always know what they want to hear, not just what everyone else knew they wanted to hear, but what they didn't even dare name to themselves. Show them the pattern. Give them permission to do what they wanted all along. And that's how she operates.
And can I just say,
yeah,
that's why it's so insulting for someone like myself to say Sherlockian, like,
yeah,
the deduction.
Because it is more than that.
It's far more than that.
It is reading people. It is deeply, deeply, deeply understanding what makes
Correct.
Particular people think. And that is how she manages to do a lot of the the consultations to the king and the advice to the king and her prophecy. Because she's also clever enough to know that as a young girl, she can't walk up to the king and say, listen, I think the Frankish king is going to do this and I think the guy over there is going to do this other thing. She knows she can't do that.
Yeah.
She's a girl, piss off.
Yeah.
But if she goes, there was a sheep that was killed and there was a crow beside it, and if she can couch these in auguries and prophecy, that is more believed.
And there was a view at the time that children potentially could have these prophetic powers because they were, in a sense, closer to the divine having just been born than we were.
Well, it's also that Hild's mother set her up for this. Hild's mother proclaimed that
a
dream.
It's not a shock. I mean, it's not a shock to everyone. You can – the idea of having a child who's 5, 6 years old with visions is not, oh, my God, that's not possible.
No.
That's actually once they've proven themselves, that's perfectly accommodated.
And the path was sort of – paved by her mother who has I mean, this is the
but it can be paved.
Yes,
it's possible to pave because it's not something to be taken as silly.
No, and augury and prophecy and everything was something that was very much living in this world.
Yep.
And it's something that Griffith does really well when Christianity begins to be introduced and the priests are coming,
and
there's this power
tension.
Struggle between the old beliefs and this new Christian belief, and so much of it is and was actually just about power and politics and money.
All it was about. It wasn't about religion. It was about
things. And that's how it's captured really well in this book. I mean, even the subplot about when and who is going to be baptized and you know the levels that you are in society of who gets to be, like, the king is the last to be baptized because that would be the most important conversion, and he's holding that back. That's what the priests want, but he's holding that back because he wants something else. You know, there's all of these machinations, and for a book which is really complicated actually and has so many different characters weaving in and out of each other's lives, I found it incredibly easy to read and incredibly easy to keep up with.
I'm glad you got back to that because that means I can segue neatly into the next bit. Because it is, it's extremely accessible and easy to read and never feels like it's departing from the 7th century with colloquialisms. You know, people don't because it would be very easy to, yes, I've said this in 7th century, but I'm going to write in a modern tongue. Nicola doesn't do that, but it doesn't make it inaccessible. On the other hand, bookended to this is a book that was shortlisted for the Man Booker this year and, in fact, was nominated for the Goldsmith Prize, which was The Wake by Paul Kingsnorth.
Okay, not really.
Now, The Wake is about the Norman invasion, which I knew fuck all about.
Right.
And now I know more about. What I wasn't aware of, and this is relevant to Hild, what I wasn't aware of is how the Norman invasion essentially ended Anglo-Saxon culture.
Yeah.
So this 7th century is very much, we're still, yes, the Christianity is coming, but Anglo-Saxon culture is still important in terms of, not necessarily in terms of faith now, because Christianity is there, but definitely in terms of things like the clothes they wore, the language they spoke, Old English. Okay.
Well, there are multifarious languages in this, and that's the other thing. Like, this book is complex and acknowledges
true,
complexity.
But Old English was
so it's not just Anglo-Saxon.
But there are
different languages.
But for the Anglo-Saxon kings, Old English was the main language, as I understood it. Anyway, the Wake does is this is obviously the Norman invasion comes, the French come, and essentially change England forever, or change the British Isles, whatever you want to call it, forever. And so what Kingsnorth does is he argues that you can't really write a historical novel in the colloquial, in our language, in our modern tongue, because it says something like, it feels like they're drinking cappuccinos and they've got iPhones. You know, you can't do it that way. So what
now
he
I
does,
know the book that you mean.
So what he does is he writes it in a pseudo Old English. So it reads like Old English, except I wouldn't have a clue what Old English it reads like. So I have to trust him, much like I trusted Nicola with her history. But he's made it more accessible because he says, if I'd written it in actual Old English, first off, it might have taken me my entire life. And second off, you wouldn't understand a single word. Now, what's interesting is that even though his novel is based in the 11th, 12th century, he's decided to take that move, whereas Nicola, in terms of language, has decided to just not restrict herself, but just write in a more oldie fashiony type of style without having to actually write in Old English or
oldie fashiony.
Yeah, well, because she's stripped out. What she's proven is that she can write that way with and not have the colloquial stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a sense, she, even though her book comes before the Wake, she proves that the Wake didn't have to be written in the style that Kingsnorth wrote it in. She, although I didn't mind Kingsnorth style, I found it quite accessible.
She has written in it. I mean, it is a stylized use of language. She has been very careful in her attention to language. I was doing some reading around the book, and for example, and she acknowledges herself that she probably hasn't done it like perfectly, but she, in the beginning of the book, before the Latin priests came, she tried not to use language which had any derivatives from Latin. She tried, you know, she really has paid attention to this book,
and it's peppered with Old English and Latin, and
she's used the English words when there is no real trend, like the word weird, W-Y-R-D.
Yeah.
We really don't have an accurate translation for that, so she's used that word. And there are other words scattered in there.
She uses words like thane and all that sort of.
Yeah, and there are words there that's the word. And if you translated it to another word, the connotations we have around that are not quite the same thing.
Except she's used modern grammar. She's used modern syntax. Full stops and
absolutely.
You know, commas.
Yeah.
Kingsnorth doesn't do any of that. There's only full stops. There's no capital letters, and you know, structurally, there's no commas. Mm. It's all feels like run on. It's still very accessible. I was able to read it, which is a shock to me.
But that in itself is also very, because as you say, he's invented a language anyway.
Yeah.
He hasn't actually used Old English. And it's also just a very stylistic choice, because we're still reading this now. We are coming to these books and worlds.
Yeah, true.
Now,
but for him, I think the thematic idea is that the Norman invasion changed that area forever, and also essentially killed off Old English.
Yeah.
So that's why he's using Old English, because
he's appropriated Old English and made his own, because that's not as accessible.
Yeah.
So it's a bit cheeky.
Well, he calls it a shadow tongue. He's
I like the idea of shadow tongue. I think that's nice.
But he's done that on purpose, because that's what was lost. So in a sense, it's a reminder of what was lost.
Yeah.
It's not as important for Nicola, because there's a number of centuries before that's going to happen. And
but she does not only acknowledge that there are, you know, different and competing languages in the British Isles at this time, but it's not just an acknowledgement. She actually weaves that into the story, and it's really important. I'm just going to read a couple of lines where she's talking about, and this is when Hild's a three-year-old, and this is her perception of just three different languages that she's exposed to. English voices, words drumming like apples spilt over wooden boards, round, rich, stirring, like her father's words and her mother's and her sister's. Utterly unlike Onan's otter-swift British or the dark liquid gleam of Irish. And I mean, it's beautifully written for a start. And there's a whole lot about language in this book, so like who you speak certain tongues to, what language writing is made when it starts to become more common. So she can speak Irish to the Irish priest Fursey. Most of the time, knowing no one else will be able to understand what they're saying. You know, and this is like all of these languages are there. The Griffith has represented this world, not just this is England, you know, because it's not.
Yep.
It's these competing fiefdoms and counties, and they have their own languages and their own culture and their own political structures, and they're all competing against each other at this time. This is not a uniform world with one king. Evidently not. Yeah, that's the whole story of this book, is Hild's uncle Edwin trying to become over king. It is a multifaceted world. And I think she's invoked that beautifully, and she's done it via acknowledging the different languages, by acknowledging the power struggles and the politics. And even though this work is centered around Hild and the upper strata of the societal structure, we get to see so much of the rest of the people.
Yep.
And how the whole world works at all levels.
Yep.
And yeah, all through Hild, because yep. Hild's in, I think, almost every scene. There are a few tiny little things that aren't. And also, actually, the voice of the book is fantastic, because you talked about she's created this, what did you say, oldie-fashioned-y?
Yeah, oldie-fashioned-y.
The voice of the book, it is an omniscient voice. Most of the time it's speaking from Hild's point of view, but it is an omniscient voice, and we do get these other facets, but they all surround Hild. So even though there are scenes here and there where it's another character and Hild isn't there, they're usually observing Hild.
Yep.
Or making some kind of connection with her. Yep. So the book is very strongly, Hild's like this magnet and everything is drawn around her. It is. I read there was a reviewer on Strange Horizons, actually, who is a medievalist, T.S. Miller. And he pointed out that, which I hadn't thought of, but that essentially Hild is a Lives of the Saint.
Which means what?
Well, the Lives of the Saints were books that were written about saints, and they were a genre.
And was there one on Hild?
No, of course not. We know there's no one on Hild.
No, why wasn't there?
I don't know. Talk to the Venerable Bede. I don't know. But
you mean of the time,
at the time. And that's what this reviewer, Miller, is saying, that essentially this book that Nicola Griffin has written now, is like
Lives of the Saints. Okay,
it's
gotcha.
Lives of the Saints book.
Yeah, okay. Which
I hadn't made that connection.
14 centuries.
Yeah, written now, a few dozen centuries later. But that's what it is. It's the Lives of the Saints in much protracted and extended form than it would have been written in medieval times. But this was a genre of book.
I doubt those Lives of the Saints would have characterized their saint as a bisexual. See how weave that in there?
I see you weaved that in there.
Did you see how I did that?
Yes.
Because it's a critical part of the novel.
It is. It's also, I mean, talk about anachronism. That is a very anachronistic term.
Bisexual?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not used in the book.
No, it's not. No, it's not. That's what I mean. Like us pointing it out now is almost, it's beside the point in the book, because
no,
it's
but people
not
have
seen
ar- but you see, there's on one of her blog posts, people have someone has asked, why did you make Hild a lesbian or bisexual? Mm. A lesbian,
yeah.
Actually, I think the question was, and her response is, I say first, she's bisexual, not a lesbian. Second, why the fuck not? But I can see why people, and I admittedly had this reaction, because, you know, as I said, naturally prejudiced and discriminatory, thinking, but did they have bisexuals back in the 7th century? And you're right, it's a term.
Well, you know
of
what? No, they didn't.
Because the term didn't exist.
The term is very – there's a really, really good book called it's just called Straight, and I can't off the top of my head think of the author's name, but I will dig it out at home and put it in the show notes. And it's actually a history of the construction of the idea of the heterosexual.
Yeah, because that's – you're saying that's
and
the
it's,
thing
it's, – that's fairly recent. This is not like, it's not as though everyone used to just be straight
and monogamous and straight
and monogamous and straight and somehow in the last century or so we invented the idea of homosexuality and then bisexuality, and that's no, we have compartmentalized, and this is fairly recent. So to say Hild is bisexual is a very 20th century / 21st century labeling of this woman. You know what I'm getting at?
Here's the thing. And this is where it becomes it's so problematic. I don't even like using the word problematic, but it is. And that is that this is a saint.
Yes.
So later in her life, the idea of
sainthood is very constructed. Sorry, keep going. But
yes, you've basically made the point. She's a saint. She's going to run an abbess. Is that how you pronounce it?
Well, she is the abbess.
She's the abbess.
She'll run an abbey.
An abbey, yes, yep. Sorry.
The male version would be abbot.
Abbot,
which is
yes.
The word you're probably more familiar with.
Yes, I am. Yeah. Thank you. She's going to run an abbey. She's. I don't know when the celibacy element came into Christianity, or if that was relevant then.
Well, celibacy is like, that's Catholicism. It's not blanket Christianity.
Well, I know Catholicism. Yes, I understand that distinction doesn't exist then, but I'd wonder if the liturgy required them to be celibate back then anyway.
That I couldn't tell you.
And I don't know either. Yep. And so let's not go there because we just sound like idiots. But you still have, based on a 21st century, 20th century perspective, you still have this view of a very austere, ascetic sort of person who wouldn't have had a sex life. And it's very much, and it happens in Judaism as well, that when you have great figures, saints, rabbinical figures, whatever, they're in a sense neutered. Of their early life is neutered because they've obviously become this great person.
Yeah.
So they couldn't possibly have been tainted by anything even remotely dirty like sex or money or anything.
This is the thing, is though the more we – well, I almost deify – the more we elevate people on a moral or spiritual plane, the more we seem to need to carve away anything that's bodily about
Correct.
Them.
Correct. That's right. Now, what's interesting is that Nicola has made it the point of not starting this book when she's in the Abbey, and this is just a, you know, a recollection of her time.
Oh, yes, this could have been one of those.
Correct, could have been framed that way,
here I am now on my deathbed.
Deathbed, or speaking to a young.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that.
Young,
that would have been terrible.
A young woman who's in the Abbey going, oh, well, I remember.
Well, man, back in my day, we had sexes,
Instead, she started at the start, essentially.
Yeah.
And therefore, we will get that full picture once you've read the
Which
entire
is,
trilogy.
It just occurred to me as you've said it, actually quite an unusual, like in terms of contemporary fiction, genre and otherwise, a very unusual way.
I know. I'm reading a lot of literature at the moment.
To start and with as a small child and watch them grow up.
I'm reading a lot of literary stuff at the moment. Flashbacks are fucking everywhere.
Yeah.
No one ever fucking stops. It's flashback city.
Yeah.
This is what I loved about this. This is just, and not because it's linear. I mean, I don't need it to be linear. It's just because this is about her youth and she's going to grow up and da 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 da.
Yeah.
And doesn't have to have a flashback to when I was eight and I was the seer for the king.
It's very trusting of readers to, and I think it's trust well placed because the assumption that someone is only going to read a book about a young girl and young teenager if we know already from the framing device at the start that actually she's in this really interesting place. And that's what, you know, in a way we kind of have that anyway because – the whole meta frame of the book is that this is the woman who will become St. Hilda.
But you could forget that. You can read that book and...
Yeah, but the book itself explicitly doesn't do that.
Correct. There's no foreshadowing. There's no hinting. She's a seer, okay?
Yeah.
Which has a religious connotation, obviously, to it. Christianity comes. She gets baptized. But there's absolutely zero feel that this woman is going to end up in an abbey one day. In fact, the book ends with her, you know, in a putative relationship and that.
But the book does.
She's starting to recognise her sexuality.
Sure.
The last thing you'd think, she's going to end up in an abbey.
Well, the novel ends there.
I know.
The book ends with Nicola Griffiths afterward talking about St. Hilda of Whitby. So it is, I know what you're
afterward,
saying,
though,
that the novel.
Afterward.
But it's packaged with the book. The flap copy is part of the way you read the book. The afterwards, all of that is packaged there. So we are essentially given a framing device. We are given that exact framing device that you were glad the book, the novel itself.
It's not the same thing, though.
No, it's not the same thing because the novel itself, the novel from page one to page 300 and whatever.
It's more than that.
Doesn't do that, right? But the way the book is packaged, and I'm not talking about even like outside stuff that you have to go on the internet to find. The book itself, whether you get the digital version or packaged. Like, so we are given this frame. We are told this is the woman who will be St. Hilda. So in a way we are mollified.
Yes,
in that
I agree.
Way, right?
And that's why I agree. And that's
which
why
is why the book itself probably doesn't have the novel itself doesn't have to
but
do
that's
that.
How I came to my conclusions because that's why I love the fact that it does this tells the story the way it does because, yes, you're right, we know that, and you're right, there is an afterward, and I happen to have read the afterward, I think, first.
Right.
Which was purposely not a good move. But
even the flap copy, if you're going to read that.
But
that
I never read flap copy.
Yeah, not necessarily talking
plus,
about you.
plus, I'd read her blog, so I already knew St. Hilda.
So we've got the framing device.
So you get this juxtaposition. Forget the fact that it's bisexuality or whatever. The fact that she has a sexual life and that she's recognising her own sexuality is, you know, in my head, has a friction against the fact that this is going to be potentially someone who's celibate. I don't know.
That's really interesting because I didn't that didn't bother me at all because, as I was saying before.
Bother is a very...
The lives of the saints, are they are
don't use the word bother because I was not bothered.
Okay, not bothered, but it didn't strike me as, the friction or anything? I didn't get that because when we talk about...
I think that's the correct
The word. Lives of the saints, I mean, come on, they're fictional lives. These are lives that have been constructed around these particular figures that have been elevated to the idea of sainthood, which if, you know, you don't necessarily believe in actual sainthood, is a fiction in itself. you know, that this was like a real story about a real person who ends up being part of this created narrative around sainthood.
But Ian's head keeps going, yeah, but you become a saint? How could you be doing this naughty sex stuff?
No, 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 she doesn't. See, here's what's important to remember. You can't become a saint while you're alive.
No, I know.
Hild never, ever in her entire life becomes a saint.
No, I get that.
Never. This is constructed around her after her death. So what Hild does...
Is what Hild does.
Is what Hild does.
Yep.
Which is really interesting. But as you're talking about her awakening sexuality, I wanted to read this one bit because Griffith is so clever the way she writes this. There's no hackneyed moments. There's no really tired or even like lightning bolt moments. There's no suddenly, oh yep. my God, I have a vagina and I want to use it. You know,
that would have been genius.
It is just a really subtle.
It'd be funny if she called it a vajayjay.
Yeah, not so much. Because also, Hild is very, very, very occupied with the life of the mind and the life of politics and the life of the court.
Yep.
So, you know, she's quite preoccupied. But there are these beautiful little moments that Griffith slips in there to tag to you that Hild is becoming a young woman. And it's not even something she's acknowledging to herself. And that, I think, is the beauty of it. And the one of the benefits of using this omniscient voice, because you can do that. You can have a voice which is very much grounded in a character and mostly in that character's point of view, but you get to slip in things that...
Go ahead.
So I'm going to read you this part. And this is talking about Hild looking at Ulladas, who is her servant.
Yep.
A slave, actually. And then later becomes just a servant because Hild releases her. At the time, she's a slave and she sleeps at the end of Hild's bed. And so I'll just read this paragraph, and this is Hild. That night, she dreamed of seawater coursing over her glistening skin, of flying underwater and over it, and woke in the glimmer of dawn with a shivering yearning, delicious and unnameable. Ulladas, sleeping at the foot of Hild's bed, didn't stir. Hild watched for a while. The curve of her cheek, the top of her shoulder where her shift had slipped, had the bloom and sheen of just-risen cream ready to be licked. And that's it. It doesn't go any further than that. And there are these little moments like that through the second part of the book leading up to the point where Hild realised, I have a vagina and I want to use it. that doesn't happen. But, yeah, like there are these little bits. And we know what they are as adult readers. We know exactly what those feelings that she has are, even though she doesn't know herself yet. And it's just so deftly done. And it made me realize again that this very real, very textured depiction of female sexuality and female desire for other women or men is not that common. It really isn't. And it's you know, this is often filtered through a different lens. And this is very much a female lens.
Yes, and I won't be alone. You still have to fight against prejudice. I keep using the word prejudice because it's not that. It's preconceptions mm-hmm. and of what things are meant to be like and how we've been brought up in understanding what a saint, even though I don't know if sainthood means nothing to me, yeah. I'm Jewish, but just the idea of what a saint is. And this then for Nicola to put in this sexual awareness element feels
but she's a human girl.
Correct. Well, yeah, I know, but just because you brought up the lives of saints, yeah. I'm pretty sure they didn't.
Though. No, obviously not, no.
Yes. So anyway, look, I think – because we've probably got to move on to the next book.
We do have to move on a little.
What I want to say just finally mm-hmm. is that this is a book that has been massively researched. However, it is not a book that feels like it's been massively researched. It feels like a book that reads beautifully and well. In other words, it's not Tom Clancy having to put every a little bit of information into the book.
That's the difference between someone who uses their research well.
Yes.
Because for me, this book, I could see the years of research in this book on every page.
But like, it wasn't bogged down by it.
It was so evident.
Hild doesn't stop and provide exposition every 2 minutes.
She didn't. I think the phrase is, your research is showing.
Correct.
And that never happens. Because the knowledge that she has amassed about this world that she's working in is just evident on every page, but it's part of the world. It's part of the
Correct.
Book and the story. It's not, oh, now let's have a paragraph about how they make yarn. But How They Make Yarn is in there.
I'm pretty sure if I was Nicola Griffith, I'm not. My name's Ian. I would have had this urge to talk about the geopolitical stuff, you know, just have tangents. By the by.
But that's all in there. It's just all part of the story.
Correct. It's integrated perfectly. Yep.
Another thing, just before we move away from Hild, the other thing I really wanted to point out is that by necessity, because the book is about Hild, and even though there are occasions when she does go off with the Yseith, her soldiers – who she has, they're not really soldiers. Anyway, again, language, very important in this book. And she does go away and do things with men.
Yeah.
Like most of the book is around her and the women because this, you know, the society is bifurcated like that. There is women's work and men's work. And I think Nicola Griffith has trod a very delicate but successful line in pointing things out without it seeming that Hild is this progressive 20th century woman dropped into a 6th century book.
Absolutely, yes.
So I think that's very, very well done. It's not didactic. It's not Hild looking around and going,
The progressive element comes, I would say, is when she buys her slave.
But she does buy the slave.
No, but she does it because she feels that of a mistreatment, and then she constantly wants to not, you know, cut off she doesn't want to have her as a slave.
Oh, she does for a long time. She doesn't even think about it for ages. Well, it's not until she's actually in a sexual relationship with her that this begins to trouble her.
Okay. All right. Well, still, anyway.
And it's interesting because she does draw a parallel in the book explicitly where she thinks about her sister who's been married off.
Yep.
To another king, and Ulidas, who is her slave, and she looks at these markets and thinks, well, my sister is exactly the same. Like, my sister has been sold like a pig at market. She doesn't make what would be an anachronistic stretch to then go, oh, so Ulidas is also a slave, and that is bad, and maybe I should, you know, the connections that she made is it's not good for her sister to be a slave. She doesn't make a connection at that stage that slavery itself is maybe not so great. So it's a very delicate line of sensibility and awareness, and I think Griffith does it really well. But the point that I wanted to talk about was this is very much a book which there is a great emphasis on the women and what they do and the work that they do to support the entire society.
Yep.
As much work as men do and as important,
yep.
But it integrates it into the story. It talks about their lives and the work that they do and their responsibilities and their value in such a way that it's not talking down to that. It's not just – because, you know, in our grand narratives, important stuff is war and politics, right? Stuff men do, war and politics. Whereas, and we all know the women stay at home and make – and, oh, let's just have a little story about them doing their stuff and that will be their story. This is a book which talks about how integral and important women's work and women's knowledge.
Frankly, the women's participation. The men don't eat, don't have clothes.
Don't have clothes, don't eat, don't, you know, and we see this and it also brings in the importance of the entire hierarchy of the society from the people who are tending to the sheep to the people who are growing crude. You know, as I said, it's this really fulfilling textured narrative which really doesn't cut anyone out of it. It just presents this world that once you, you know, to use again a tapestry metaphor, I guess, you started pulling out a thread, the whole tapestry would collapse. You can't do that. All the threads are bound together. Everyone is important. Everyone has their place in the pattern. Now, reading it as, you know, 21st century readers, we can maybe decide that the pattern itself could do with some deconstructing. But the idea of the pattern and whatever that pattern is and everyone actually having
a role
worth
to play, yeah.
And importance in that pattern is quite an important concept, and I think that's something that runs through the whole book. So, yes, highly, highly recommend Hild. Can't wait for the next ones.
Yes, I recommend it as
Looking forward to rereading this in anticipation of reading the next one.
Of course, I won't read the next one. I won't read the next one unless it appears on an award ballot. So,
Or I recommend it for the podcast.
Or you recommend it for the podcast, exactly. So the next book is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel.
Which you recommended.
Yes.
Why did you recommend it?
Well, I read it because it was an award book. Wow. Which was nominated for the National Book Award. Didn't win. That was won by another very good book called Redeployment by Phil Clay, which just as an aside, highly recommend that. But Station 11 was my favourite book on that ballot, and I recommended it because it was my favourite book on that ballot. It also happens to be a genre novel, which just made it work neatly into the podcast. So essentially, I'm not going to do it. I don't have the book here in front of me. I'll give a bit of background. Yeah. It's the end of the world. No, it's – well, it is. Essentially a Captain Trips type virus, because I did, you know, have memory of Stephen King.
Totally.
Yes, comes and kills off mostly everyone over the space of a period. But this story isn't really about that as much as it's about a bunch of characters who are linked to an actor called Arthur Leander, who, you know, is essentially your – big Hollywood star who's probably on tough times now, is coming towards the end of his career. So is still the paparazzi are still interested in him. Mm. We'll still take photos of
him.
And
he's gone to the stage, so.
But he's now gone to the stage because he's probably not getting the roles that he used to get.
Maybe.
Anywho, he dies in the first couple of pages before the virus hits, which is – I love that irony. I love it. That was one of the things that I fell in love with immediately is that the guy who essentially is caught in this novel isn't actually killed by the virus. He dies before it even happens. He dies on stage, like any good actor, has a heart attack. And essentially his death spirals out and we get the story of both his past. So this is not a book that dwells on the post-apocalyptic future, but really connects the two, both the past, a little bit on the present, and then what happens 20 years later after his death, and the society and the earth that we have. And there's a couple of characters who are connected. There's his one of his wives,
two of his ex-wives.
Well, one of them's a point of view character, the other isn't.
Yep, true.
His best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor, sort of half doctor.
He's training
to be a paramedic who comes to save his life on the stage. And the brilliantly, the child actress who is acting with him in the, I think it's Macbeth or whatever they're doing.
Yeah, King Lear.
Which is
important, actually.
It just shows how, you know, I know it is. It's King Lear. The child actress who was playing the role and what happened to her 20 years later.
Yeah.
So that's what you've got. I'm not going to say much more because I'll just make a fool of myself. but I loved it. I get the feeling you didn't, Kirsten, and I'm going to have to fight you on that one.
It was an interesting experience, actually, because for the majority of reading the book, I really enjoyed it. I was really engaged. I said to my husband, I was like, this is a really good book. I'm really enjoying
what
it.
What happened?
I found the ending to be just a letdown.
Well, what did you expect?
I don't know, but I guess
the whole book is about life goes on.
Yeah.
Life goes on.
Yeah. But
that's the whole point of the book.
Yeah, I know. Like, what? And?
No. But the whole construct is.
No,
but the whole thing is that this is the most hopeful post-apocalyptic book you'll ever read. This is a book where. And that's just what.
Not the ending, not like the last three pages of the end, but the final act, I guess, of the book with the prophet and all of and going to the airport and all of that sort of stuff. I just thought, yeah, it was very. I mean, the prophet shat me, honestly, that whole thing.
I agree, is the weakest part of the book.
And that was where the book started to tumble down. And then, yeah, thinking about it, like over the past couple of weeks.
Your hatred has grown.
No, it's not hatred. It's just I don't hate this book. I just think I feel really kind of, I feel ungrateful. Because one of the things I really liked about this book was that I felt it could have been the book that I've been asking for, the book which is a post-apocalyptic book which isn't about how shitful people are to each other, which, you know, is actually about rebuilding worlds and having hope and having lives. And you know, yes, there are still crappy people out there, but most people, as I do believe, are actually good to each other. And help each other.
Which is why I think the prophet stuff, although I think it is the weakest bit, is so clever because it doesn't become the focus.
Yeah, but it's so pat and so cliched and so.
No, but I think
it doesn't do anything.
Brilliant undermining of that because it's to say what you expect in these books is some weird charismatic leader to pop up.
But he does.
And I'm going to have him. But frankly, he dies essentially off screen.
But it's just. I don't know why.
Because he's not relevant. He's not important.
But he is important because he actually.
He's important in terms of Arthur.
He drives the narrative.
Well, no, he doesn't.
He's the reason.
Arthur drives the narrative.
He's the reason why.
Arthur's life drives
the narrative.
He's the
reason why the Travelling Symphony are doing exactly what they're doing throughout three quarters of the book,
which is escaping him.
Yeah. and go, like, he drives a narrative.
Yeah, but that assumes that the Travelling Symphony story, which is the, which is what, just for our people who haven't read it, the Travelling Symphony is essentially a group of people who have got together and decided to share Shakespeare and other plays amongst the disparate communities.
It's Shakespeare.
It's, and other plays. They make up their own.
By the end of it, they don't. That's the whole point. They don't make up
their
own.
They do.
They don't. In fact, there's that whole argument with the person who's just called the clarinet, where she's saying we should make up our own plays. And Dita says to her, oh, okay, go and do it then. And she goes and writes one line and then gives up. I mean, this is one of the problems I had with the book, actually. This is a book which is about how, you know, they use the Star Trek tagline that survival is insufficient, which I absolutely agree with. So it's a book about allegedly about how important the arts are and how it's not, you know, just enough to just survive hand to mouth, you know, like the animals where we are born, we breed, we die, and that's life, yeah, right?
Well, the message you got is we're just going to shove Shakespeare down people's
and
throats.
And yet, who is actually creating anything? Where are the arts creators?
First off,
everyone's running around doing like 600-year-old plays.
First off, how you interpret those plays is an act of
the best of the world.
How you interpret those plays is an act of creation. We don't know. They don't do a full performance in the book. Second off, I don't believe that's the feeling I get, that this is just about how it's all about Shakespeare, because there are other forms of arts.
I know he's emblematic. Yeah, but we don't see them, do we?
Yeah, we do.
We see the comic, which again is from the old world.
We have that beautiful museum that's being set up. I love
it's
this.
It's a museum of old things. Where is the new? Where is the new stuff that's being created?
20 years later.
So that's a gen. Where is the new stuff that's being created?
This is.
Everything is about salvaging from the old. Like, yeah. And here is where it really did not. That's kind of a side thing. That wasn't what I was thinking throughout the whole book. That's something that makes me sad. I would have liked to have seen creativity in this world happening. It is not. Survival is insufficient. The past is also insufficient.
No. And the key element for this world 20 years later is not to forget the good stuff that came out of the past, because it's the past that killed us. The past is bad because the past let the virus out.
Yeah.
We all died. Well, most of us. But let's not forget the good bits.
I'm not sure I believe that anyway.
What?
Well, she's got this virus and she's done it for very dramatic effect, but the three characteristics that she's given, she's amped up all three. So she's got almost 100% contagion rate.
Yeah, okay.
Right? If you around someone with it, you will get it.
Well, so do
almost
trips.
100% mortality.
Yeah.
So
okay.
If you're around with someone you'll die if you get it. And 48-hour time period. I'm just not sure. That virus gets around the world and kills 99%.
Really? This is what you're picking at?
I am picking at it now. But that's okay.
Did you like The Stand? Because that's basically The Stand.
Yeah, but you know what The Stand did? The Stand did what this book doesn't do. I think The Stand is a highly optimistic book. I think that The Stand, and, you know, granted, The Stand's like four times as long. I have not read it for a while.
Yeah, 1,200 pages. But, yeah.
But this book, while it is not about how cuntish people can be to each other for the most part, which I really did appreciate, contrast this with Hild, which we've just read. Think about the world of Hild, which is essentially the world that this book should be in, except worse, because they haven't got generations of knowledge to build on about how to harvest crops and raise livestock.
Yeah. I'm waiting for it. I'm waiting.
Where is all that? This life feels sentimental and easy.
Like, no, I don't think it does.
They hunt. There are 320 people at the fucking airport. They have four cows and a handful of fucking chickens. They've planted some crops along the narrow pastures. Like, they're making bread. How have they got the flour? I want to show me this world. Don't just talk about how, you know, it's kind of hard. I want to see how it doesn't feel hard to me. And in fact, it's not just me either, because then when I went and
they don't need shelter because they live in an airport.
And, by the way, the toilet's still running 20 years later just by throwing buckets of water down them. And where are they getting their clean water for drinking?
I don't know the...
This is what I'm saying. If you're going to do this world, it's not enough to just say survival is insufficient and people are nice to each other and let's have hope. How are you actually going to live in the world? if you're doing this as a bell jar exercise and you're saying, well, let's not worry about that. Let's just set it 20 years in the future and just gloss over how people picked themselves up and dusted them off and rebuilt community and rebuilt society and rebuilt bonds and built trust and built a world. Let's pretend that all happened in 20 years and we'll just gloss over it. Doesn't have a lot of relevance.
I was happy to just assume all that stuff because obviously they're alive.
The book is saying
they're alive. So obviously they're farming. They're doing stuff. They've obviously got a brook nearby that has clear water.
No, it's not obvious. It's not obvious. What? And in fact, it's like this is the difference. This is so the
we need chunky, stodgy writing.
Is Hild chunky and stodgy?
Hild is
chunky and stodgy.
Hild is only set in its world. This thing moves backwards and forwards
I don't want people just sitting around talking about shit. Why can't they be talking about shit while they're out hoeing fucking fields, milking cows, learning how to make flax, all this stuff they need to do? This is not inbuilt in this world. I do not feel, and it's not, as I said, it's not just me. I read other reviewers who are going, yeah, I don't feel this is... This doesn't feel real. This feels too easy. And like all of this stuff that I'm saying now, I wasn't really articulating it until I came across like all of that but I was thinking about why is it bothering me so much? Why can't I just read it? Like here's the book I asked for, right? It's a hopeful, optimistic, post-apocalyptic world.
Bring it out.
And then I read this little review on there's a blogger called The Skeptical Reader. And I'll just read one paragraph that I've taken from her review. She says, overall, this is a very relaxing, serene novel that is not only easy to read but speeds by once you really start connecting with the characters. It's not overly done or pretentious. Mandel writes a story that almost makes us wishful for such a tranquil existence in which we can finally begin to enjoy life as it was given without squandering our time obsessed with artificial and materialistic things. And that solidified my unease with the book because that is really what the book is. This book is quite a nostalgia trip. It really is. It is about, well, if we could just put, I mean, there's whole discussions about how we used to use text messaging and artificial language and contractions, heaven forbid, contractions. So what? Here's the thing. The book is called...
Let me talk, eh?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
The book is called Station 11. Now,
based on a comic.
Okay. The book is called Station 11.
Yes.
Considering that you have a Christian prophet, considering that you have a religion and Christianity are packaged through this book, it's not too far a stretch because it was actually the first thing which popped into my mind.
Stations of the Cross.
Stations of the Cross. And what is Station 11? The 11th Station of the Cross is the actual crucifixion. So if we're talking about – and this book is about a world that has been sacrificed for the good of a small group of other people who get to go on.
Yes.
So if we're talking about this book, which is as other reviewers – and as I have felt and as other reviewers have either explicitly reacted to themselves or just noted how they thought the book – what the book was saying is about how, well, you know, let's blank slate it and let's start again and let's all be nice to each other and give away the iPhones and the computer games and the texting and the, you know, the corporate speak and all and just get back to what it means to be human and to be real and to connect with each other and to perform
that
Shakespeare.
That is not the only message. That is not the only message. Yes, there's a definitely get rid of the corporate speak because frankly it's useless.
Right, but if that's right, if that's it.
But the museum isn't there, in my view, the museum isn't there as all the stuff that we should forget about. It's there to remind us of what we were. But not in a negative cautionary tale sort of way.
I know, right?
Well, then how is it? But you're saying that Mandel's message is let's get back to a free lifestyle without all that shit.
What I'm saying is that this is definitely one of the themes of the book, and this is certainly the tone and one of the communication threads that people have drawn from the book.
No, see, for me, this is a response to dystopian. It's called a dystopian novel, which it isn't, but it's a post-apocalyptic / dystopian things where everything is dark and dismal and sad and everything's fucked.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is
She makes explicit references to The Road and The Passage and things. So this,
which I found funny. Yeah. Also the Star Trek Voyager, you know, the thing you quoted before. This is saying very clearly that, look, the shit has hit the fan, we're all fucked, but that doesn't mean we have to forget what we were, Okay. Yeah. And there are certain strands in our culture, in who we were, in what we were, that should be maintained, survived, remembered, and even fostered in some way.
Sure.
Whether it's Shakespeare or an iPhone. These things have value and importance, and let's not just go out into the fields and hoe, which is what you obviously wanted, a book about milking cows. Let's remind ourselves of the things that were good about us.
I want both.
So, yes, it is nostalgic, not nostalgic in a wasteful, wasn't it good in the 1950s sort of way, but in a let this stuff inspire us moving forward. Now, whether it's realistic how these people are living 20 years later, fine. I'm willing to accept the world building's a bit shaky, but the message for me – I've never been this passionate and eloquent in any podcast. The message for me trumps all that shit because I have not read anything like this before.
So what's the message?
I just said it. I've just spent the last 5 minutes saying it. Distill it down. That when we look at our world today and all the shit that's going on and climate change and da-da-da-da-da-da, it's always nice to focus on the things that are still good about the world we live in that we should be focusing on. Culture. Even technology.
Sure.
These things aren't all evil and bad. We shouldn't all be just putting our head down and going, it's all fucked. Okay. Sure. This was inspiring to me in that sense.
Yeah.
To say,
and like I said, I should have felt the same.
But you didn't.
Because you wanted stuff about backhoes. No, it felt easy. And no, I didn't want great chapters about how hard it is to dig rocks out of a field. I wanted a sense that this was hard. This world was hard, and I didn't get that sense.
Yeah, you're right.
She hasn't done the work there.
It's a little pristine.
And so it felt like a belcher. It felt like a thought exercise, which is fine, but doesn't have any relevance to me living in the world now. It really doesn't. And if I want to talk about a book where it's important to sustain cultural product, to make time for the arts, to make time for
communication. Yeah, you wouldn't have written this book, that's clear.
Then I want to see people doing it. I want to see people doing it, not just producing Shakespeare. And they make very...
So the guy who sets up his own newspaper.
Yeah. No,
so we discount him as being a creative...
No, he's in there, but he is just setting up a newspaper.
So?
Right? He's communicating news and other people's
stories.
And just
having even if they're just doing Shakespeare, just having a travelling symphony is of itself a creative act.
It is.
What do you want? What do you want?
You know what I want? I actually want there to be, and not the small amount of, like, the clarinet saying we should do other things and then she disappears anyway and she doesn't even do anything herself. I actually want there to be signs of people doing their own stuff. I really do. I want that there. I don't just want Shakespeare is what's best of the world.
So you want...
You know, I really don't want that. I love Shakespeare, I do. But the idea of Shakespeare's plays still, again... being this lazy touchstone to something which is apparently universal and epic and with something we can all connect to. No. Do something different. Like, you made up a comic character, make up something other fucking thing that you're doing. Or have new things. I want people being people. And it didn't feel like this. This really felt more like a bell jar story, more like an exercise. And the fact that... there was no real struggle here. And, you know, the world, let's also face it, you've got the chapters in the book which talk about all the things that have been lost. Let's face it, great amounts of the world don't have those things now. Have never had them, don't have them. Life's going on pretty much as these people are living. Like, this book doesn't deal with any of this stuff. It's a really insulated, privileged Western book.
Well, yes, it is a book about Western culture. That is a clear...
I do doubt, and I don't know whether it's just the poor world building or whether it's... I doubt the fact that this is actually a worldwide thing. I really doubt it. You know, like the flu is so fast, so virulent, so fatal, so quick.
Well, it started in Russia.
Yeah, well...
The Georgian flu. Yeah. So it would have gone through Europe.
Yeah.
But
the point is...
You're missing the fact that there's half a novel here that you're not even talking about. Focusing on the 20 years later, there's a half a novel you're not even referencing, which is the story of Arthur Leander himself. I mean, let's not forget that he's critical to this.
Yeah.
That his life is
critical. Well, he's the I guess, the starting point for this particular collection of stories.
But didn't you ask yourself, why bother with any of that stuff? Why bother about that commentary on Hollywood, the commentary on the paparazzi, the commentary on ego and star and all that stuff?
No, because it's a counterpoint to how people are sort of presented as living in the post-apocalypse. That people are presented as living a more authentic life, that it's not about, you know, there is no paparazzi, there isn't, you know, everyone connects more.
So you think it comes back to the idea of
there's less artificial life.
Thank God we sacrificed all those paparazzi.
Like 99% of the world, if you take the book at face value, that's a huge fucking sacrifice for 1% to, you know, get back to fucking nature and play a bit of Shakespeare.
I don't think Mandel's saying, hey, if we have a vial of this shit, let's let it out. Because
I think this is what the book is presenting. I don't think Mandel's saying that. That's ludicrous. I think the book is presenting this. And as I said, like, I read the couple of lines from that reviewer and that really solidified it.
Yeah, but that review seems to be implying that going back to an idyllic...
But this is how the book kind of makes you feel. Okay, you read...
It didn't make me feel that way at all. It made me feel that there's something good about our current lives.
And there is. And there's some
paparazzi in Hollywood aside, there is something good about our culture and about Western, I should say, because you are right. This is very much an American Western culture novel.
Not total American either. There's people in America who don't have the stuff that has been lost. I mean, this is really stratified stuff here. And I do feel that it's, you know, it's one thing to write.
By the way, we know it hit other countries because it hit Malaysia.
Yeah, I know.
The virus is just... Okay, keep going.
I'm just kind of, I think that's just a world-building failure. I think she's bet too much to make the virus too dramatic, and you didn't actually need that. You could have had a more realistic, anyway, it doesn't matter. That's a tiny thing. I'm willing to accept that, yes, it's not unreliable that the 99% of the world has actually succumbed. Where are all the bodies, by the way? I just wanted more because
good question. They're probably rotting in the houses that no one goes into.
If you're going to do this,
there's that image of the plane, by the way, talking about where the bodies are.
The plane is fantastic.
Of that plane where no one's allowed to go.
The plane lands in the airport and no one comes out because at least someone on the plane has the virus, so the plane has self-quarantined itself.
So we know that
there are moments in this book that are absolutely beautiful, and that plane is one of them. And that's one of the places the book, like, I didn't hate this book. And there are moments when it really shines. And one of those is that plane. And what I wanted was more of that, not more of, you know, the immediate post-apocalyptic stuff, but more of the hardship and the struggle that we have now, that you would certainly have post-apocalypse. I want more to make the point that the book is making, that there is stuff worth salvaging, that there is stuff that we need to appreciate now, that there is stuff that should an event like this happen, there's stuff that we need to consider when we're rebuilding that is of value, that isn't just about food and money and so on. To make that point, you have to make me believe in this world. You have to make me, like I believed with Hild, make me believe in this world. Show me, don't necessarily show me the bands of brigands and rapists and cannibals that the road had, you know, that's an aspect, that's fine, but show me the hardship, show me the struggle.
I'm glad you brought the road up because that is what this is an antidote to a book like
it
the
is
road.
And I think it's a bad antidote because it's not acknowledging that stuff is hard. It's just hard, and in spite of that we will do things. And there's this other review, because I knew I was going to get pushback from you because I read your review and I went, oh, he really loves this book. There was another review I found on...
You really went to town on the reviews. Fuck me.
No, I didn't. I haven't actually noted on my paper where this is from, but I will provide a link in the show notes. So it's by Sigrid Nunishept. I'm sorry if I've mispronounced that. And she says, she talks about how the survivors do not think, act, or speak like people struck by such a cataclysm. For the most part, they do not behave very differently from people living in ordinary civilized times. Hunger, thirst, and exhaustion are alluded to, but there is no penetrating sense of the day-to-day struggle of vulnerable human beings lacking the basic amenities of life. And that's what I'm missing.
Because it's not trying to be that book.
But it should still be there.
You could fucking read a million apocalyptic novels about people scrounging around.
Yeah, but Ian, it should still inform the book. In the way that Hild is not a book about farming or weaving or milk production or anything of that, and it's not. It's a book about politics, and it's a book about power struggles.
No, but you said in your statement
that,
that it is
informs that book.
No, you said very clearly about Hild that Hild very much is about those things, about tapestry and farm production.
All that world building informs the world. Yes,
it does more than just inform.
But the overall story of the book is Hild and the power struggles and how Christianity took over.
Okay, fine.
Okay, that's the big thing,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And that is informed, made richer, yes, and made real by
all of the world and a time that we frankly know fuck all about.
Whereas in Station 11, that's not there. It's not there. And I don't want great tracks of, hardship, porn. What I want is for that
hardship
to
porn. I love that. Yeah, that's
I
good
want
one.
That. I just want that to inform this book, because otherwise, as I said, you're talking in a bell jar.
Well,
if you're not acknowledging the real struggles and the real interpersonal problems that humans have, if this isn't part of your book, without bloating it out.
Well, the traveling symphony is a metaphor for that, because there are interpersonal problems there. Well, what? It's all there.
Are the traveling symphony, how are they self-sustaining?
They hunt.
It's not that fucking easy, Ian? It's really – that's what I mean. It's all just, they'll do this. Oh, we don't need to worry about the plumbing because they're still putting water down the toilets 20 years later. Oh, we don't – we've got some cows and some chickens and some things out there. And there are these tiny little sort of brushing aside things, because this is not what I'm – this is not what the book is about. I'm not writing about that.
Yeah,
that's
not
what the book
exactly.
Is.
I'm not writing
I don't
that.
Care. That needs to inform your book. That needs to inform your book. Well, otherwise – it's way too easy.
Normally you persuade me and sway me and I know. But I'm not this time.
No, that's fine.
I feel that this is a book. Yeah, maybe it is in a bell jar. Maybe there is this pristine apocalypse that she's created just to make a point. But I think the point on its own,
I don't know why you'd bother doing it to make that point, because you could make that point in any number of settings and stories.
Really?
Yeah, I think
it's lovely. Go tabula rasa, kill everyone off.
Oh, see, that's the point. It's lovely, kill everyone off. That's the point I'm making. If we cannot imagine these things and these concepts and these arguments without the need to kill 99% of, let's face it, mostly brown, black and yellow people, so us white people who are left standing can work things out.
G-Van's
and decide what's okay. If that's what you need, then your imagination is lacking. Our imagination as readers is lacking.
I think it's a book in dialogue. Fair point.
And it's clearly.
But I think it's a book that's in dialogue with books of its type.
It clearly is. I think it has swung the pendulum way back the wrong way.
Okay.
It's okay to look at The Road and The Passage and The Walking Dead and texts like this, which talk about how horrible everything is and how horrible people are to each other and how the nice person, the generous person, the compassionate person is the rare person, and they usually comes back to bite them in the ass anyway, so we should all just hate each other. Yes, I think there's a counterpoint. There's a much needed counterpoint to be made to that narrative. I don't think this book did.
I think this does. I think it provides a non-sentimental, you disagree.
I think it's incredibly sentimental.
Optimistic take.
It's very optimistic.
with some beautiful writing.
Yes, no, look, the writing is gorgeous.
And I think getting caught up in world building and why is there no water with the shit into plumbing or whatever the hell that was about, stuff that I frankly ignored. Because I agree, the prophet stuff is the weakest part.
And
I said that in my review.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then you've got the prophet who is just a very predictable, seriously, the whole...
I just love how she builds up Arthur's character. Mm. We get a sense of a guy who doesn't even feature in the post-apocalyptic setting.
Because he's the past. He's the past pushing through to the present.
Correct.
Still.
Yes, and I thought that was just lovely.
The writing throughout the whole book is really beautiful. And I really like the structure that's done between the past and the present. I think using characters who have died in the past and who have made an impact through their work or their legacy, like Arthur, like Miranda, who I thought was an exceptional construct, I think that all works really well. What I'm saying is that it falls down. This is the pendulum swinging right back the other way, away from the road, and we need to have somewhere in the middle that acknowledges that all of this stuff that this book is talking about, the importance of culture, the importance of real connection, the importance of – I mean, well, this book doesn't talk much about the importance of webs and networks like Hill does actually. This book could do with more of that. We need all that. But we also need to acknowledge the cost and the sacrifice.
Of milking cows.
The overall human cost and sacrifice, if this is what, you know, if we as readers want to read about this world because blank slate tabula rasa
no,
isn't
okay,
that lovely,
okay, fine,
we need to acknowledge the underwritten cost of that.
But the horror is there. I mean, especially the guys in the airport, when we get their glimpse and we see that they're watching this, they're watching the monitors, they're seeing that it's, you know, the newscasters of.
I don't even want the book to be, like, one of the refreshing things I liked about it was that for the most part, it didn't dwell in that immediate post-apocalypse. Like, it didn't dwell in that. And that's not what I want. I'm not saying I want this book to go back to that period and go through the whole how did we survive. I want to look at what they're doing now. How are we living now, 20 years later?
Okay.
And I want to feel that we have a very real way of reestablishing communities and reestablishing trust with each other. And I see this as people
communities
living.
Communities have been reestablished?
I see them living on the scraps of the past. They're not even building. I mean, it's just. An airport tent, sheets
that
made
is
out of
not
hotel,
the only
tents made out of sheets in an airport.
That is not
really,
the only community. That is not the only community that
I know
is depicted in this book.
But it really,
we have G-Van's, community.
But these are really communities living off the scraps of the past. The only mentions that are, you know, there are very fleeting mentions made to they're roasting a deer. They've planted crops beside the airport runway.
And it's not scraps of the past. It's not scraps of the past.
There's more attention paid to salvaging from the past, to the museum, to all of this stuff. I want to see how we reassemble.
All right, and we're not going to agree.
No, we're not going to agree. But no, it was not, like, as I said, for the most part, I enjoyed reading it. And there was some great, like, I love Miranda's arc was fantastic.
Her last scene when she's sitting on the beach is just magnificent.
You know, I was genuinely, you know, saddened and grief-stricken when Miranda died and she wasn't one of the ones who survived. You know, there are some great parts in the book. And I thought, you know, the treatment of the prophet as he's a young boy and his mother was really deftly done. And I that's why I was so disappointed in the whole prophet thing, because I thought that was going to be much more interestingly handled. And it wasn't. It was very cliched and tropes and very easily dispatched.
I agree.
Dispatched
it's the weakest
with.
Part, but I don't think it kills the novel, because you have other issues with the novel that kill it, which I don't entirely agree with. But that's all right.
Yeah. And I really, 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 really wish they hadn't put those bloody illustrations at the end of the comic. Did you have them?
No, I was reading the ebook. I didn't get the illustrations.
I got them on the ebook and they're at the
end. No, really?
Yeah, they're at the very end. And they're not good. And the whole book builds up these amazing images in your head about what Miranda's work actually looks like, that no one could ever come up to that anyway. And I really wish they hadn't succumbed and got someone to
draw. I'll have
to
go back to my ebook.
Yeah, they're not great. And they're certainly nothing like what. And honestly, if she spent like 10 years working on those, it's like, yeah.
God, you are a critic, aren't you?
It's inconsequential to the book. If you're writing in a book and you're describing a work of art that you're describing as, you know, amazing and transformative, not only for its creator, for the person who has received it at the end, and you're building this up, you really can't provide that work. You just can't. Because no one is going to be able to do something which meets the imagination of the readers. So I think that was a really bad misstep. But that's the side thing anyway. See, I am picky. I'm sorry. I could see why you like the book. I am unconvinced.
Yeah, you can now patronise me about my enjoyment.
I'm unconvinced, that's all.
All right, well. Look, even though you and apparently a whole bunch of reviewers have castigated this novel.
It's not castigated.
Castigated the novel. I'm going to read just one bit, which I think sums it up for me, but in fact probably feeds into your point. So not necessarily doing myself any favour, but I actually think, yeah, anyway, it fits both into both our points, possibly. Clark looks up at the evening activity on the tarmac, at the planes that have been grounded for 20 years, the reflection of his candle flickering in the glass. He has no expectation of seeing an airplane rise again in his lifetime. But is it possible that somewhere there are ships setting out? if there are again towns with streetlights, if there are symphonies and newspapers, then what else might this awakening world contain? Perhaps vessels are setting out even now, travelling toward or away from him, steered by sailors armed with maps and knowledge of the stars, driven by need or perhaps simply by curiosity. Whatever became of the countries on the other side, if nothing else, it's pleasant to consider the possibility. He likes the thought of ships moving over the water toward another world just out of sight. There you go. There's your creativity. He imagines a world of new symphonies, of new things being discovered. That is what he's there doing. And yet here you are going, oh, it's Shakespeare all over again and Western culture, which that bit's true. But, you know, it's there. It's in the text.
That's the last paragraph, isn't it?
Of the whole novel?
Yeah. Isn't it just about the last paragraph?
No, I think it's one of, maybe, I don't know. The point, it's in the book, okay? The point is it's in the text.
At the very end. Look, I appreciated, I really genuinely appreciated that this was an optimistic and hope. I did. I just think, you know, as you can go too far one way and say it's all shit and everybody's bastards and blah, 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 yes. I think it's possible to go too far this way.
I don't think this one does, but fine.
And, you know, I also think, if you're gonna do this tabula rasa thing, if you're going to clean slate it, if you're going to kill 99% of the world, have a really good freaking reason to do it. Like, honestly, I mean, because this is real. We are talking about, okay, not real people. It's fiction. It's books and movies and TV shows, obviously. But the romanticism attached to the tabula rasa is really troubling because in reality, if we did have a tabula rasa, it will have necessitated the deaths of billions of people, real people with real lives. And yeah, I don't think that is something you get to separate from a book.
Okay. You can have the final word. No, fuck it. That's my book. I'm having the final word. If you're looking for something that is optimistic and smart and at times funny, it's actually quite funny at times, which is funny. Something that's nice. God, I've read some earnest novels recently.
Miranda's.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
I've read some really earnest novels recently. So this was, you know, this is quite funny. And I think says something good about the way we live, even if it is Western-centric. Okay, sorry.
99% then of the world
I would recommend Station 11. If, however, you want more world-building and backhoes and want there to be more creativity in the post-apocalyptic bits because to show how are they moving forward.
I do.
Because the Travelling Symphony ain't enough for Kirsten.
No.
Then don't read it. Okay, so what are we recommending for I don't know how that was even a good last word. It was just me repeating what we're anyway.
That's a really condescending paraphrase of what I spent half an hour talking about. Finish.
Okay. That's what you're recommending. I thought this might be what it was.
So, books for next month.
Yes, books for next month.
So, I am going to recommend.
Mm-hmm. Shall I can't just say it? Or do you want to?
I'm recommending it.
Okay, so you say it then.
I will say, I was starting to say it, and then you just cut me off.
This is for February, remember, people?
This will be February. I'm going to recommend The Bitterwood Bible by Angela Slater, which is out in paperback as well, I should say, by Tartarus Press. So you don't have to go and buy the expensive $80.
Have we done Angela before?
No, we've not. We've had Angela as a guest on the podcast, but we haven't
done her work.
No, we haven't done her work. So this will be new. And I've not read The Bitterwood Bible yet. So I'm hoping I like it. So that is a collection of short fiction, and it is a prequel of sorts to her Sourdough collection of short stories from a few years ago. So, yes, I'm very much looking forward to reading it and talking about it in February.
Okay. And they have the female factory, Lisa and Angela have the female factory out right now.
Through 12th Planet Press, yes. I believe it's in the mail right now for people who've
e-book is
pre-ordered
for those,
or subscribed. Yeah. And, of course, the e-book is available immediately.
Yes. Okay. My book is a book I've spoken about quite a bit, and it's vaguely genre, vaguely, but I think it's amazing. Better than Station 11, all right, Kirsten?
Okay.
It's Ali Smith's How to Be Both, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker and won the Goldsmith Prize. It's short, so I always have to think about that for you. It's actually two novellas that are interlinked. Now, what I want you to do, Kirsten.
Okay.
I should have done this before we started the podcast. So what
do
I might get you to
do this on the podcast?
No, yes, it's critical.
Okay.
I might get you to just to pause the podcast for a moment while I just set myself up.
I'm going to pause the podcast.
Okay.
And we're back. from the pause.
Yes. We actually just spent the last 6 weeks.
You built a whole house.
Correct. I took all that inspiration. I took all the inspiration out of Hild and the lack of inspiration from Station 11 and built a house and did something with regards to flax. I don't know. Anyway, so it's two novellas, Ali Smith's book.
Okay.
One of them has a pair of eyes sort of on a stalk.
Oh, on the cover.
That begins it. And that begins it. So okay. You'll open the book,
okay,
whether it's an e-copy or whatever,
okay,
and you'll get to the first page and you'll either see a sort of CCTV camera image or a pair of eyes. I'm now showing them to you because you're giving me this look.
Okay, and I need to choose one, do I?
I'm telling you which one to choose.
I'm telling –
Because the order matters.
Okay, which so you're telling me the opposite order to what you've read it?
Did I even need to do any of this?
With the above below books that we did with Steph Campisi and Ben Peake a while ago?
Correct.
Which were Australian books.
So I read the eyes first, then the camera.
So I need to read the camera.
The camera first, then the eyes.
Then the eyes. Okay.
All right.
Interesting.
That is how you have to do it.
I will promise. I promise I will read the camera first.
Camera first, then eyes. Okay.
Okay.
I'll say no more.
All right.
Okay. Good. That's what we're doing.
I love how you had to put that on the podcast. You couldn't have just told me.
No, because actually for our people who read on, they might want to either read the way I did it or read the way you did it.
That'd be really interesting. And we can get people to write in and tell us.
Who's going
to
give us feedback? No one gives us enough feedback. They give it on Twitter. Actually, on Twitter, fine. They
can
give
exactly.
Yes. Okay, we're done. We're done. You know what we have done very well?
What
gender. We barely review men. In fact, I'm surprised the person who emailed you did say, do you do Australian authors and men? Because you don't seem to do
it's
either.
Not true.
Well, the last two books, the ones we just did were two.
Yes,
two women.
But if you go and have a look at our list, I think it's slightly favoured in weighted in favour of women, but we do a lot of men.
Do we?
I think it's one of those things where if you have more than, 32 women out of 100, suddenly it's dominated by the ladies.
It's dominated! Okay, send feedback to... if you'd like to, of course, I'm not forcing you, to the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com. Email us at writerandcritic@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, writerandcritic. I do most of the responses there. And then, you know, iTunes, 5 stars, 4, 3. You know, give us 1 star and tell us why. And it's probably because of the reviews that you gave on Station 11. Someone will go, how dare she?
How dare
she? It'll probably be Emily St. John Mann.
How dare she?
1 star. And I'd also like some... genuine and honest feedback on cultural cringe around Australian work for Australians out there listening to the podcast.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
So is it just that Ian is a dick splash?
Well, me too, obviously.
And Kirsten as well, but I wouldn't have never said that of you because I'm a gentleman. Oh.
No, it did surprise me actually that you would call me a dick splash. Yeah. No, it did surprise me actually because it was something I didn't think I really had much left of, but obviously I do.
A bit of splash.
Bit of cultural splash.
Yeah. So, yeah. Do any of you actually feel that way about Australian genre work? Specifically, we're a genre podcast, but it can be non-genre. Mm. Or are we just completely fucked?
Be really good if, like, people under 20 don't have that anymore because it means it's fading. That would be good.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm done. This was actually quite good.
It was interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry I didn't love your book to death.
You don't have to love the book. I mean, that's why we do it. So one of us recommend. Did you not read the notes on the first podcast? That's why we do it this way.
Well, I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm going to be recommending books I probably have not read just so I can read them.
Could be fascinating.
That should be fantastic. And by people I know, I'm going to have so many friends by the end of next year.
Woo, and who? Is there any chance we're going to go to monthly again?
Not next year.
Okay. It's worth probably mentioning.
Maybe
that.
The year after.
Ooh, hello.
But not next year.
Okay. All right, cool. I'm done.
See
bye.
How much work I get done. Okay. All right. Bye.
See ya. Bye. Muddy waters on the range. It is muddy all the day.